Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Elise Hoag, who's a columnist with The Nation and was previously the Director of Political Advocacy and Communications for MoveOn.org, where she previously served as its campaign director. Before joining MoveOn, she spent 7 years as program director for the Rainforest Action Network. She has an article at The Nation, Money In, People Out, The Twin Pillars of the GOP's 2012 Plan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elise Hoag.
Thanks, Ian. It's great to be with you.
And it is pretty clear that the Republicans have a plan, and it has many facets, and it's highly organized. It involves the Republican leadership. It involves ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. It involves a kind of cadre of billionaires. But it obviously goes back to before 2012. Recently in the Weekly Standard, Fred Barnes, a Republican propagandist, if you will, was actually celebrating how much the super PACs had helped them in 2010. And in 2012, it was just going to happen exponentially. So we've seen what's happened in Wisconsin. Can't they just simply carpet bomb the country and win this one?
You know, that's what I find so fascinating, Ian, is that if you actually step back and the whole picture comes into focus, it's clear that the GOP does not believe they can win on ads and money alone. And neither do I, quite honestly. I mean, as, you know, a progressive, I believe that our biggest advantage is that we have plenty of people. And you know, when the people have a voice in the system and can exercise their constitutional right to vote, more often than not, they are going to side in their best interest, which is with the more progressive of the candidates. Well, the GOP understands this, obviously. And so what's been fascinating to me, as I wrote in the piece, is, you know, while it's the money they flaunt, it's actually the people that they fear. Hence their sort of lockstep, hand-in-hand strategy of voter suppression, keeping the people out, and carpet bombing the country with ads, bringing the money in.
But in the Wisconsin recall election, apparently 30% of union members voted against the repeal of or the recall of Governor Scott Walker, and 50% of union households voted against the recall of Governor Scott Walker. So that tells me that the progressive side is seriously lacking in educating their voters.
Yeah, I absolutely don't want to gloss over the fact that there's an issue with our ability to actually mobilize people. And it's not just mobilizing, it's inspiring, right? Like, people absolutely have to feel as though their vote's going to count in the end for them to get up, take off work. You know, we're one of the countries that doesn't actually give you time off work to go vote and actually go cast your ballot. I would caution your listeners about extrapolating too much from Wisconsin to the federal election. The exit polls also showed that despite the fact that the recall effort failed, Obama was still leading in Wisconsin. So I think this is a bit of apples and oranges. In fact, you know, I wrote another column. What I really think was going down in Wisconsin is that folks were just election fatigued, right? Between 2010 and 2012 and what went down, there was an election every month, every couple months, every 2 weeks at certain periods of time. And there was a fatigue that set in, and there was a general feeling that the recall itself was overreach, that we should only use recalls in the case of illegal activity and not legislative malfeasance. So I would just caution your listeners to say, oh, well, that happened in Wisconsin, so it can happen nationally. I actually think we're facing something very different this November.
And I think you have to add to that that the candidates that the Democrats chose to run against Governor Scott Walker was less than inspiring, and he was recycled from his previous loss in the last round. So that might have been a factor as well. So apparently in these swing states, Obama's latest television ad campaign is apparently having some effect, that pinning Romney to the outsourcing and making the comparison that Obama's the president who insources, Romney's the guy that outsources, And also these lingering questions about Romney's wealth and how much of it's hidden, and the fact that he hangs out with billionaires who are basically, in large part, funding his campaign. Is that your understanding, that this early framing of Romney by Obama is being effective?
Yeah, I've read the same polls you have, but I'll tell you what, it doesn't surprise me a bit, Ian. You know, one of the things that people are really desperate for right now is a candidate that they can trust to not, to A, understand what they're going through, and B, want to fix it. And I think people already had questions about Romney's ability to understand what they're going through. He shows how out of touch he is every time he walks up to a guy at the fairgrounds wearing a poncho and says, hey, really spent the big bucks on your rain jacket there, or refers to NASCAR owners as his friends rather than understanding the sport itself or the drivers. He's out of touch, right? So then the question becomes, even if he's out of touch, do we think he wants to help us? Right? Do we think he actually is going to empathize more than the current president and shift our situation? And the Bain stuff is just incredibly damning on that front. He showed no understanding and no remorse for the number of people he axed from their jobs, shipped them overseas, shut down factories. It was all in the name of profit. And I think it's just, it's a big blow.
Well, Elise Hoge, you mentioned a little while ago that the U.S. is among the few countries that don't give people a day off and that they vote on Tuesdays, whereas most other democracies vote on the weekend. I think it's actually pretty much alone in its history of voter restrictions and, you know, as much as we celebrate the founding fathers. Myself, having lived in other European countries and Australia, I have some sense of comparison, and it's pretty extraordinary the number of hoops you have to go through to vote and how arbitrary they are and how they, on a different state-by-state basis, they can be gamed. So we know that the Brennan Center did a study about a year or 6 months ago that suggested that up to 5 million people, eligible Democratic voters, are going to be purged by these Republican state government initiatives to, supposedly in the name of voter fraud, to demand voter IDs and other restrictions. That seems to be working, but on the other hand, there are a lot of lawsuits out there, and the Attorney General may not be putting Wall Street banksters in jail, but he seems to at least be on the case in terms of trying to strike down these voter restrictions, which he's recently referred to as a poll tax. Do you have a sense that the Attorney General is going to prevail?
I think it's a question of timeline, isn't it, Ian? I think that the Attorney General seems actually quite genuine in his effort to preserve the vote for every American, but he's also exercising his force within the constraint of the law, and there's a process that has to be gone through to adhere to the way our legal system works, and eventually it ends up with the judiciary, which, someone once said to me, and it stuck with me, the left sees the courts as a pathway to justice, the right sees it as a pathway to power. And so when we started to see a judiciary that's motivated by politics more than by the law, you have to be concerned about that as a long-term strategy. But I support what Attorney General Holder is doing in terms of holding their feet to the fire to make sure every American can vote. I think, you know, the question is really whether we as Americans are going to come together and recognize that, again, these are two parts of the same plan, and that this is the length that the Republican Party will go to in order to win an election. It will rob American citizens of the one right that allows us to believe we live in a representative democracy. And you know what? I think that they think the impacts to the integrity and the trust in our form of government, be damned. They're going to win the election. And for any American that actually cares more about our country and about what makes it great and what keeps people loving it and keeps people trusting it more than they care about any individual candidate or any individual party, this is an outrage, and we should be standing up.
Well, do you think that appealing to people's sense of patriotism and sense of fairness And it seems obvious that in the real world, you should be able to shame every Democratic candidate ought to be able to shame his Republican opponent into recognizing how disgraceful it is to not even want to have a level playing field and to resort to those kinds of anti-democratic and historically disgraceful ploys of restricting and preventing people from voting. But I just wonder how much the electorate is so damn jaded with all the money that's pouring in, all of the hit jobs on both sides. Are we at a point where we have lost our sense of outrage?
Well, I think that we really have to guard against apathy. I think it's real, and I think we have to not only talk about, point in the direction of all the different fires burning, but offer an alternative that actually makes people want to engage and believe that their engagement has impact. But I actually think that the first thing you said is really critical for your listeners to understand. Not only is this part of one plan, but their part of their strategy is to divide and conquer. If they keep one constituency of Democrats focused over here and the other over here, look, the Achilles heel of their entire strategy is the voter suppression stuff, because people understand that is the heartbeat of our democracy. That's why you had so many companies pulling out of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. They knew that they could not, either by their conscience or because of their brand integrity, they could not stand to be part of a body that actually took away that heartbeat of democracy. So this is the Achilles heel of their whole strategy. The question is whether we will allow ourselves to be divided and distracted in all of these different directions, or whether we can recognize the entire plan for what it is and be strategic in how we actually stand up for our democracy and stop their takeover.
Well, at least, Hogue, it would seem, though, that equally and opposite in terms of this 1-2 punch, the twin pillars of GOP's 2012 plan that you've written about in The Nation, Elise Hogue, money in and people out. We've just talked about people out, the people out strategy. The money in strategy, one of the things that I find extraordinary about it, and again, it seems that so far they're getting away with it, is these so-called social welfare vehicles that the IRS have set up that are now being used, and under a Wisconsin Right to Life ruling, it's open sesame on the ability of not just billionaires, but corporations to hide their political donations. And we know from the last cycle in Wisconsin, where the homophobic candidate was supported by money from Target, the big retailer.
Yeah, that was in Minnesota.
Minnesota, yep. Right. That there was a tremendous backlash to that. And we know that basic corporations are very careful about giving their money because they don't want to offend half of their customers if half of their customers are Democrats and the other half are Republicans, which is pretty much the way it is in this country. So what about that? I mean, the money in part is so opaque that that's what concerns me, and I wonder if there's any way to flush that one out before November.
Well, I mean, there are a couple of ways, right? There's a court that's ruled that disclosure is absolutely necessary to allow voters to know who they're voting for. There's another vote on disclose, the actual legislative bill coming up at the end of the month in the Senate, and folks should absolutely, this matters. This is a time where the senators, because their own self-preservation is at stake, because every Democratic senator can see how he or she might go down if things continue on this track. This is a place where they're willing to step out, but they need to hear from their constituents. So there are a couple of ways to do that, but you're absolutely right that that there is more corporate money flowing into the system than we originally understood. It's just being shielded by these C4s. You know, I think the bottom line is none of this is rocket science to fix, right? We know we need transparency so voters absolutely understand who it is that's backing the candidate so that they know where the candidate's loyalty will lay. We know that we actually need a system that says corporations are not people and unlimited spending actually is unfair to every voter. We know that we actually need to stop voter suppression, and we actually know that we need what I call citizen-led elections, which is the matching system that New York City has, that Arizona has, that says only when you have enough support in your own district, then you can get matching grants from the government, And we know that that increases the diversity of candidates. So these are things that we know how to do. We only need the political will to do them. And that's what's going to get people over the apathy. This is not a question of not having a solution. The solutions are there. When enough people stand up and say, I've had it, it's not because it's about the Democrats winning or the Republicans winning, because at the end of the day, it's absolutely not. It's about representative democracy that made America what it is, persevering. That's when we're going to have the political will to implement the solutions that already exist to these problems.
So, Elise Hogue, just to finish up on the money in part of the 1-2 punch, money in, people out, the twin pillars of the GOP's 2012 plan, the article that you've written in The Nation. I did an interview recently with a business investigative reporter with the Boston Globe who investigated the first big deal at Bain that Romney made his biggest killing on. And it was financed by Michael Milken, who himself was under SEC investigation at the time. But, and you know, I have very limited resources compared to the rest of the media, but just with a cursory inquiry and with the help of a friend of mine, Jonathan Taplin, who's a sharp guy in terms of knows the business world, we find out that all of the big super PAC donors, Adelson, David Koch, and Simmons, were all financed by Michael Milken. And Koch himself is, of course, on the chairman of the board of Milken's foundation. So there's a kind of weird DNA to this story. And I wish other people, I know you've pointed out here what the self-interest of Adelson is in getting rid of Obama and having Romney elected, and he's prepared to spend up $100 million, and that is because most of his money comes from offshore, from gambling casinos in Macau and Singapore. He wants that loophole open where the U.S. Treasury can't tax all these offshore profits. But what do you think about some good forensic financial investigation here? Don't you think it's needed?
Yeah, I absolutely do. And I think we're going to see it, right? This Department of Justice has been more aggressive in pursuing some of these cases of American companies operating outside of the law overseas to make maximum profits, to keep them overseas so that they're eroding our tax base. And, you know, I think that the SEC is going to get involved as well. But I think the point that you are underscoring is the self-interest involved. You know, there's been a lot of, like, a sort of wringing of hands about whether the Democratic super PACs can raise as much money, and I address this in my piece. You know, the answer is no. They absolutely can't, because they're not offering the same return on their investment. Adelson is paying $10 million, which, you know, when you are worth what he's worth, which is $25 billion, that's absolutely nothing. Because what's at stake there is a whole hell of a lot of money, but also his freedom. He's being investigated, and you're not going to find Democratic candidates that are, you know, horse trading like that. Some will. This is not a party of purity, right? The whole system is corrupt. But we see that more on the right than we do on the left, and therefore the super PACs are raising more money because there's more transactions to be done in the business world. And you know what? My biggest fear, again, goes back to democracy, because when the rules get changed, then people change to fit the rules. And if both parties actually start behaving in that transactional way in order to compete in the elections, then 90% of Americans get left out of the process.
Well, just in closing then, Elise Hogue, I mean, it seems obvious to me that Adelson's already had a profound effect on this election. You know from the New York Times story that that Romney and Netanyahu are extremely close and they go back a long way. And there's no question that Sheldon Adelson has devoted his fortune, or is prepared to devote his fortune to Netanyahu. He's funded a television network like Fox in Israel. He's also funds a free newspaper that's given out that's devoted to Netanyahu. And it's difficult not to see why he backed Newt Gingrich in the primaries, because Newt Gingrich split the anti-Romney vote. So arguably, I mean, this is my theory, that Adelson's been supporting Romney all along. I guess the question about money on the right versus money on the left is that there's so many of the guys on the right seem to have a direct financial interest in their candidate and what they're going to get out of him when he becomes president. Conversely, on the left, you got the guy they compare the money bags on the right to is George Soros, but I don't think he has a lot of stuff before the government. I mean, so the people on the left have to give out of altruism. The people on the right give out of self-interest.
I don't know that it's altruism. I mean, I think that's a misnomer. I think that even high donors who give to Democrats actually believe that everybody does better when we all do better, that their businesses do better when consumers have money in their pockets to go shopping, that their cities and their communities are better when the schools are funded and we're turning out an educated workforce. So I think altruism is overrated. It's a nice idea. I think it's really just that the people on the left are not looking for a direct one-for-one trade, often, where in many cases, not all, but in many cases, at the big donor level on the right, you know, like Adelson with his legal troubles, you can find something that they're really, really seeking.
Well, Elise Hoge, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Anne.
Again, I've been speaking with Elise Hoge, who is a columnist with The Nation and was previously the Director of Political Advocacy and Communications for MoveOn.org, where she previously served as its campaign director. Before joining MoveOn.org, she spent 7 years as program director for the Rainforest Action Network, and she has an article at The Nation, Money In, People Out, the Twin Pillars of the GOP's 2012 Plan. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how much money Mitt Romney's hiding offshore.
So excuse me, mister, but I'm a mister too, and you're giving mister a bad name, mister like you. So I'm taking the mister from out in front of your name, cause it's mister like you that puts the rest of us to shame. It's a